The creation of the United States of America is the central event of the last 400 years. That premise sets the tone in the first of a new trilogy of books detailing the history of the United States by our guest today, Walter McDougall. In fact, McDougall goes so far as to say that if a ship sailing in the year 1600 were to mysteriously time warp into the year 2004, much of the world would still be recognizable: India, Europe, Japan. But he says the place that would absolutely perplex our time travelers would be the continent of North America, which has completely changed in 400 short years. 13 ragtag colonies made up of Quakers, Puritans, Cavaliers, Catholics, and immigrants, all with different beliefs, all with different customs and ideas of laws and morals, yet all with a common vision: to unite and create a land that would in the end be free of the English crown, left alone to worship and do business they saw fit. Still, it is amazing that these 13 disparate groups actually got together and beat what was the world's greatest power, Britain. Founding Father John Adams once wrote that it was as if 13 clocks were made to strike together. Today in The Exchange, the colonies and the creation of America up to its Declaration of Independence. We're with author Walter McDougall. His book, Freedom Just Around the Corner, A New American History, 1585 to 1828, is the first of a trilogy of the story of the United States and the hundreds of brave, brilliant, and flawed people who made America great. Our show with Walter McDougall was taped last week, so we won't be taking any phone calls today. Walter McDougall, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Oh, Laura, thank you so much for inviting me on the air in the Granite State, because this gives me the opportunity to offer very warm greetings to all my Vietnam comrades in arms in the 3rd Battalion, 197th Artillery, New Hampshire National Guard.
Wow.
I loved you guys, and I was honored to serve with you. I feel like I'm an honorary Granite Stater.
Well, Walter, we're glad to have you, and I want to talk to you about this idea of an American culture or America as a unique place. What is it about our creation that makes us unique in the world?
The American people have had the opportunity, the blessing, to be the freest people in the history of the world. Now, you can trace that in great part, of course, to our English roots and English law and constitutional development and so forth. But obviously our geographic remoteness of the 13 colonies and then the nation at large has allowed the United States to, throughout most of its history, to be free of intervention from abroad. And, of course, the constitutional development of the colonies and then the early United States itself made this a remarkably free nation. Now, why does that make Americans unique? It means that the American people have been able to indulge the whole spectrum of human nature, whole behaviors from heroic and good to bad and ugly.
Well, and that raises a point that you make again and again in the book. You say that part of our national character is that we are hustlers.
Oh, baby, are we hustlers. How did we build such a gigantic, successful, powerful, rich nation so amazingly quickly? When you look at the whole spectrum of world history, the United States is still the new kid on the block. And yet here we've become what people are calling the new Roman Empire and greater than the Roman Empire and so forth. And that's because, I believe, the American people are hustlers. Hustlers in the good sense of the word, in the sense of being dreamers, hard workers, industrious, team players, very charitable people, go-getters. On the other hand, Americans have also been real good at hustling in the, shall we say, pejorative sense of the word. Scofflaws, getting around any authority or restriction on their behavior. America never saw a law they couldn't get around, which, of course, started with our rebellion against the British.
Well, where does this hustling character come from? I mean, why people who came here?
I trace it to Tudor Stuart England. I mean, how can you avoid that? The 13 colonies were all planted by British colonists, mostly English, but then very large wave of Scots-Irish as well, who came out of the British Isles in the 17th and 18th centuries. And so they carried with them various characteristics of that English and then British culture. And not only, of course, a commitment to the ancient rights of Englishmen and a resistance to monarchical authority and all the rest, but also England was becoming the world's first truly capitalist society. Now you say, wait a minute, capitalism, I thought that was invented by the Dutch or by the Italian city-states, or haven't people traded with each other with profit and loss since the beginning of history? Yes, but for a whole society to become capitalist, the 90 to 95% of the people who lived on the land had to begin to engage in market activity. In other words, food, land, and rural labor had to become subject to the marketplace. And this happened in England for really quite accidental reasons in these centuries, say the 1500s and 1600s. And consequently, the English colonists who perhaps couldn't make it in England or who dreamed of getting rich in America and the New World brought with them a culture that was already hustling, that was already market-oriented, that was already capitalist, acquisitive. And this was very productive, but of course it also had a downside. Because one of the principles or traits of English capitalism was a belief that enterprising, productive people had a right to push aside what they called savage people, or peoples who were not developing the resources or the land that God had given them. The first victims were the Irish, but then, of course, the next were the Native Americans.
I want to talk to you about the British colonists, and later on we'll talk about all the other colonists who made up early America. But first, that important group of British colonists. What was going on at the time, Walter, that inspired these waves and waves of people to leave?
Various trends. This incipient capitalist society in England was extremely unstable, as you would expect. Medieval society and all of the structures of life that had pertained for centuries were being overturned. Many small farmers lost their land and became paupers and wandered into cities looking for work. There were a lot of losers in this transition to capitalism in England. And so many of the early American colonists, especially all of the indentured servants, were displaced rural folk who had found their way into English towns and ports and then signed on with the hope of maybe getting their own land and building a life for themselves in America. Another great theme of English history was, of course, the Protestant Reformation and the religious conflicts that resulted as Roman Catholics, Anglicans, and various kinds of Calvinists, particularly the Puritans, were all, in a sense, trying to establish their religions in the British Isles. Kings and queens flip-flop back and forth between being more pro-Catholic or pro-Protestant. And so at various times, depending on who was being persecuted in that era, various waves of immigrants came to America for religious liberty. But what does that mean? We think that somehow this tremendous blessing, Judge Noonan called it the luster of our country, the freedom of religion, was something that these colonists always wanted. Well, then they didn't really. They wanted to get away from whatever religious authority was in the old world persecuting them so that they could then set up their own religion as the established church in the colonies and then impose that on other people.
I've often thought about that irony of, you know, people who escaped religious persecution and came here, turned around and persecuted other people.
Isn't that extraordinary? The Puritans in New England were extremely intolerant. They said to people who didn't share their congregational Calvinist faith, you have liberty. You have the liberties to remain clear of us. Maryland and Pennsylvania are perhaps the most striking examples of colonies that were founded in the name of religious liberty. Lord Baltimore, who was looking for a haven for Roman Catholics, and William Penn for Quakers. But they didn't want to impose their views on everybody else. They wanted genuine freedom of religion in their colonies. Unfortunately, the experiment didn't work very well even in those places. Within a few decades of Maryland's founding, whole waves of Protestant, mostly Puritan, colonists came into Maryland. It was a good place to live, nice place to grow tobacco and crops. And they vastly outnumbered Baltimore's Catholic community, and so the Protestants began shoving the Catholics underground in their own colony. And in Pennsylvania, the Quakers were able to create a kind of an oligarchy that governed the colony for decades, even after they lost their majority. But the Presbyterians, the Scots-Irish Presbyterians who settled Pennsylvania's backcountry, hated the Quaker oligarchy. And so you had a lot of religious strife in Pennsylvania as well.
You're getting into something that is fascinating about the book, the different colonies and how they were formed by people who were so different. In Maryland, the Catholics, as you said, in Pennsylvania, the Quakers. What about Rhode Island? Rhode Island has a fascinating story, very different from neighboring Massachusetts.
Rhode Island was the Puritans up in Massachusetts and out in Connecticut considered Rhode Island a kind of cesspool, a haven for all manner of ne'er-do-wells and dissenters and troublemakers. Roger Williams, of course, is rightly credited with founding Rhode Island as a little haven for people who were being mistreated in Massachusetts. But Roger Williams was a hustler, too. We were all hustlers in the good sense and sometimes in the acquisitive or materialistic sense. Williams was a big land speculator and businessman, in addition to an advocate of religious liberty. And he went down and realized that Narragansett and the area around Newport were very fertile. It was great horse-breeding country. And particularly that, of course, this was a wonderful port that he could trade out of and set up in competition to Boston. And he made a fortune in Rhode Island. And Newport became one of the, I'd say three or four major ports in colonial America. And incidentally, it also became the center of the American slave trade.
One of the other fascinating things about Rhode Island is that a woman was allowed to be a leader there.
Anne Hutchinson? Yes, indeed. And another dissenter from Massachusetts. She sometimes looked upon as a kind of a proto-feminist because she did stand up and insist on her rights to discuss, for instance, theology and question the church fathers in Massachusetts. But she really was a 17th century Puritan goodwife who had about a dozen children and was a faithful wife and mother and of course, a very devout Calvinist. But she insisted that women could hear the Word of God, could pray in the Holy Spirit, and have messages, sermons to preach to other people just as much as men, and this got her into big trouble, so she ended up down in Rhode Island.
Connecticut's got a good story, too, Walter. Who were some of the early nutmeg staters?
All this stuff, I love going into an entirely new topic. I've written books on all manner of parts of the world and eras of history because I learn so much myself, whether or not I have anything to teach others. And, of course, I believe I do here, but it's just so exciting to learn things that you weren't taught, not because people were trying to hide them, just because they've sort of gotten swept aside by our national mythology. And one of those is that the early Puritans in New England wanted to build a godly commonwealth, to build a city on a hill, an example of holy living for England and the rest of the world, period. But that's not true. These Puritans were go-getting, acquisitive, usually capitalist, hustlers who were also out, of course, to make a good living for themselves and to develop their colonies, increase the price of land for everybody, and so forth. And one of the greatest hustlers was John Winthrop's own son, John Winthrop Jr., who might be called the godfather of Connecticut. Yes, he was a devout Puritan, but he was also a man of science. He traveled off to Europe for many years to study the latest in medicine and metallurgy. He founded the first American chemical plant in order to do what? In order to make gunpowder so that the Puritans could be self-sufficient in ammunition, muskets, and so forth, and defend themselves against the Indians or the French up in Canada. John Winthrop Jr. went off to coast of Connecticut, the lower Connecticut Valley, and built towns and built forts, and ultimately became colonial Connecticut's greatest early governor.
One of the more interesting examples of democracy occurred in the Carolinas, right, Walter? And just the idea that, people just could go in there and hear some land, and it's just a fascinating story. How were the Carolinas, North and South Carolina, settled?
The Carolinas were relatively late comers. Virginia, of course, had been around since 1607 and New England since 1620 or 1630 when the Great Puritan Migration began. The Carolinas didn't develop until the late 1600s under the restored king after the English Civil War, Charles II, who was in the habit of signing over huge empires of land in the New World to his cronies. One of them, curiously, was William Penn, who was a friend of the future James II of England. But one of Charles's friends at court, who incidentally was a great raconteur, he was called the greatest whoremaster in England, Anthony Ashley Cooper. Cooper and a group of his associates were made proprietors of the entire region between Virginia and what became Georgia. Unbelievable huge territory comprising all of both Carolinas today. And Cooper and his friend, the philosopher John Locke, drafted a constitution for South Carolina that they thought was perfect. It was a mixture. English political thought was very much into mixed government. There should be a little monarchy, there should be a little aristocracy, and there should be a little democracy, and these will balance each other and protect the rights of all. Well, the people they recruited to settle South Carolina were largely English settlers on the island of Barbados, who had gone down there to get into the sugar trade and had come up empty. The great planters who owned most of the land and slaves dominated the Barbadian sugar industry, so whites who couldn't make it in Barbados took this opportunity to come to South Carolina, which was also a nice tropical land suitable for plantation agriculture. Except these Barbadians didn't want any part of Ashley Cooper's proprietorship or John Locke's constitution. They wanted to run this new colony themselves in their own interests and certainly not pay any taxes or obey any restrictions on trade imposed by the proprietors or the crown. So they insisted that the assembly, the elected assembly, have all the power, and they simply refused to take any orders from any governors that Cooper sent to Charleston. So this looks like these are wonderful sort of proto-Americans. They're practicing democracy and self-government. Yeah, but they did it in order to escape established authority and essentially run the show in the hustling manner that they wanted. And unfortunately also, they wanted to kill Indians and they wanted to bring in enslaved Africans in the name of democracy.
Land was so important. Open land, the availability of land was so important in Americans' abilities to enrich themselves, and yet New York City was the first place where you didn't have to have a lot of land to strike it rich.
Well, let's say New Amsterdam / New York City, because it all got started under the Dutch West India Company that founded the colony on Manhattan Island. And you're right, the Dutch colony, way down there at the tip of Manhattan, I mean Wall Street, after all, was where the wall was to protect the little town against any attacks from Native Americans or indeed from New England. Because remember, this is a little Dutch colony trying to survive at the mouth of the Hudson River. And the Dutch came to Manhattan Island for one reason and one reason only, and that was to make a profit, primarily by trading for furs with the Iroquois up the Hudson River. And then as the colony developed, of course, the port of what became New York is so extraordinarily well located that it became an entrepot for a lot of trade with the West Indies and with Europe and with, of course, the hinterland, the Hudson River, to Albany and Schenectady. And so New York really became a kind of early prototype of American urban life in the sense that, no, you didn't have to have a big plantation. You didn't have to command many workers, whether they were enslaved or not. Simply by trading and playing the market, you could get rich. Now, once you got rich, you wanted to have land, like Robert Livingston, the penniless Scotsman who came to New York and managed to make himself into a kind of a Dutch patroon, even though he wasn't Dutch, and get into the upper crust of society. He immediately, of course, purchased huge amounts of land up the Hudson and had great estates and all the rest, because that was social prestige. But he didn't make his money off the land. He made his money off trading, cutting deals.
I want to ask you about one more colony, Walter, before a break, and that's Georgia. It was to be home of a great social experiment. What happened?
Oh, my. The only trouble with it was in America, far away from any authority and occupied by a lot of hustling, ambitious people who had no time for this idealistic religious experiment. James Oglethorpe was the founder of Georgia. In the manner of William Penn, he was an idealist. He wanted to set up a perfect constitution. He wanted freedom of religion. He wanted no slavery. He wanted Native Americans treated with respect. And he wanted to make Georgia a place where unfortunates — we usually hear about criminals, but it wasn't just inmates from jails, just unfortunates of all kinds — could go to Georgia, get an education. He wanted to have schools and build new lives for themselves. In a sense, Georgia was imagined as a way of easing the social class tensions and some of the social problems like crime and poverty back in England. Well, Oglethorpe brought in a picked group of sturdy English yeomen, farmers and craftsmen and all the rest to get this colony going. As soon as they hit American shores, they said, hey, there's a continent out here for us to develop. We want land of our own. We don't want to take any orders from Oglethorpe. And look at the folks up there in South Carolina, just a few miles to the north. They're all getting rich and having a great time, thanks to what? Rum and slaves.
Mm. So let's have and that.
So, yeah, let's have that. So very quickly, the Georgia settlers threw off Oglethorpe's authority and turned Georgia essentially into a carbon copy of South Carolina.
Well, we will take a short break, and then we'll talk more with Walter McDougall, author of Freedom Just Around the Corner, A New American History. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
And I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you.
Walter McDougall, before the break, we were talking about the character of some of the 13 original colonies. We haven't talked yet about New Hampshire's character. What was New Hampshire, the colony, like?
New Hampshire was a frontier. Hard to imagine nowadays, but if you can remember that you have the nasty Catholic French up there in Quebec and off the shore very often, and, of course, Native American tribes all around, some of which were hostile or were allied to the French, you can imagine that the first towns in at that time, far southern New Hampshire, were really frontier outposts. Even Boston didn't have much authority over these towns. New Hampshire was founded, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, in 1623, very early, under a grant to Captain John Mason, who then sent over two parties of colonists after what? Religious freedom? No. Fish and timber. In fact, Captain John Smith of Virginia and Pocahontas fame had sailed past the coast of what became Portsmouth and wrote an encomium to what a glorious land this was. What sport doth yield a more pleasant content and less hurt or charge than angling with a hook and crossing the sweet air from isle to isle over the silent streams of the sea? He was writing about what became the mouth of the river at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. New Hampshire towns really began to spring forth, largely because of new immigration, much of it Scots-Irish, and also because Massachusetts was already starting to get crowded. The best farmland had been worn out or was already under the plow in Massachusetts. New Hampshireites today, I know, resent a lot of the Massachusetts people moving in, but this has been their history really from the beginning. But if I had to characterize New Hampshire, we all know what it is. Live free or die. It's a tremendous individualism, a rugged individualism, a tremendous love for liberty, more so than anywhere else in the 13 colonies.
We should talk about New Hampshire's neighbor, Vermont. And although that's not an original colony, it has wonderful story that we need to go into. Where do you even get started with that story? Vermont wanted to be its own... well, its own country at one point.
Vermonters. Well, you know, they say there's no law north of Concord in New Hampshire. Well, there's no law west of the Connecticut River either. Vermonters have been shall we say, unique from the very, very beginning. Vermont was a no man's land during almost all of American colonial history. Good heavens, the White Mountains in New Hampshire hadn't even been settled until very late in our colonial era, and the land that lay between the Hudson River and the Connecticut River was pretty much still either Indian country, or it was subject to predations from the French up in Quebec. But beginning in the middle of the 1700s, the New Hampshire governor, Benning Wentworth, began to issue charters for towns so that settlers could, if they wanted to, go into Vermont, what became Vermont, and settle. Of course, he also, being a good hustler, reserved some of the best tracts of land for himself. But these towns that began to spring up in Vermont weren't really under anybody's control. Wentworth couldn't really impose his will on these towns. Meanwhile, the Yorkers, as New Yorkers were called, claimed that Vermont was part of their colonial grant, and the Vermonters didn't recognize anybody's sovereignty over them. Well, then what happened? The American Revolution came along. Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys, who had come up, the Allen brothers had come up from Connecticut and made themselves into a kind of a bunch of Robin Hoods, kind of a Robin Hood gang type, sort of defending the small towns of Vermont. They ousted the British, they seized Fort Ticonderoga, but then they set themselves up as their own little government. And the Allen brothers, particularly Ethan Allen, in a sense, ruled Vermont as an independent country and bargained with his neighbors, New Hampshire, New York, and the British who were still up in Canada. And for a time, Ethan Allen imagined creating what he would call a Switzerland in the New World. At times, he thought of cutting a deal with the British and restoring Vermont to British authority. And his Green Mountain Boys took great pleasure in singing, "Come York or come Hampshire, come traitors or knaves, if ye rule over our land, ye shall rule over our graves. Our vow is recorded, our banner unfurled. In the name of Vermont, we defy all the world." Well, after the United States Constitution was ratified and the federal government was up and running, the question was, what do we do with this territory of Vermont, which is technically part of the U.S. under our peace treaty with the British, but was not a state and didn't recognize our authority? Well, happily, over the years of the Revolutionary period, enough new people moved into southern Vermont. The Allens hung out up at Lake Champlain. Enough new settlers came in who resented the Allens' sort of fiefdom that they were able, in one election, to defeat the Allens and win a majority in the state legislature, whereupon the government of Vermont immediately negotiated a deal with Alexander Hamilton, representing the Yorkers, settling everybody's land claims, and Vermont then quickly ratified the U.S. Constitution and joined the nation.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guest today, Walter McDougall, author of Freedom Just Around the Corner, A New American History. No phone calls today. We're talking about pre-revolutionary America, the colonies, how they were founded, how very different they were in the early days, and how they came together. Walter McDougall, I want to ask you about that subtitle, A New American History. What is so new about your approach to American history? Is it possible to have a new approach towards American history?
I asked myself that exact question for several months and fretted over whether or not to accept this invitation from the publisher to be the author of this new American history. What do I have to say that hasn't already been said a dozen times by great experts on U.S. history? Well, I finally decided there were a lot of new things or new themes or new subjects that are usually ignored by other historians. One of them, we've already talked about, is the theme of the American people as hustlers in both the good and not-so-good sense of the word. In fact, that's what led me to want the subtitle to read A Candid American History. But evidently the publisher thought that was too candid. So it's just new.
Well, you got to get the thing published, so.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the parts of the book that I enjoyed was how you wove in the fighting among the imperialistic powers, you know, the Spaniards, the British, the Dutch, the French, and how their spats and their wars bled over into what was going on in America.
Yes, they did, but I would add to that that many, perhaps most American colonists, were not at all unhappy that those imperial rivalries involved them or spilled over into their lives. One of the great myths that Americans created and have liked to believe on down to the present is that we were just over here pursuing our liberty and our prosperity and practicing our religions, and a doggone British Empire kept getting us sucked into these wars. Nothing could be further from the truth. The American colonists arrived on this continent with, yes, a hustling capitalist get-ahead ambition, but also with a deep-seated anti-Catholicism, with a ferocious hatred of the French and Spanish empires, which were not only national rivals, but also Catholic. And, as I say, this belief that the English had from the start that productive people who improved the land, who mixed their labor with the land, truly had a kind of right of eminent domain, that they had a right to possess lands that other peoples, like the Native Americans, didn't do anything with. Well, how does that translate into wars? The American colonists were hot to kick the French out of Canada, conquer the place if they could. They were hot to drive the Spaniards out of Florida and New Orleans. And, of course, the American colonists were eager to not kill the Indians, just sort of push them aside or push them back so that more new land would be available for settlement. And so the colonists were very supportive of Britain's wars against the Spaniards, the Dutch, you mentioned, and the French. They didn't always contribute as much as they might to these wars. It'd be great if the Redcoats do our fighting for us. But Americans supported these imperial wars, and in a certain sense, after everyone was defeated, after the last French and Indian War, the American colonists then turned around and decided the British themselves were the power standing in the way of their growth across the continent, and we ended up declaring our independence. I will add, though, the colonists who never failed to volunteer for the colors, to do their part 100% in the French and Indian Wars and in the American Revolution were the New Hampshiremen. Highest volunteer rate in all of these conflicts.
That's interesting. I wonder why that is.
Again, I think it's this live free or die spirit. And let's face it, there's a kind of a militancy that is bred on the frontier. Remember, I said New Hampshire was a frontier. And New Hampshiremen were ready to reach for their muskets at the first opportunity, and even not just to defend their homes, but to volunteer for expeditions, for instance, against the French in Canada. Talk about the spirit or the soul of New Hampshire. Of course, it's gone through a lot of change in recent decades, demographic changes. And now we imagine that New Hampshire is sort of on the brink of a tremendous political change. In the year 2000, as you know, all the New England states went Democratic. New Hampshire barely remained Republican. And it looks as if in 2004, it's very likely that New Hampshire will join all the other New England states and vote Democrat. And I can't help but wonder if the old man didn't fall off the mountain because he didn't want to see that happen.
What was the American psyche, if there was such a thing, Walter, what was the American psyche like as the colonists moved toward revolution?
Another new thing, it's an excellent question, and it calls to mind something else I think that's new about this book. I've got a new take on the American Revolution. I'm not denying the importance of all the other theories that historians have advanced. Indeed, I describe them. But the thing that happened that I don't believe anyone else has argued before is that the American colonists didn't dream up something new and then say, well, we want to be new, we want to create a new country, so we're going to rebel against the British. The American colonists believed that they still represented the true spirit of English imperialism, but the English themselves, after the last French and Indian War, became apostates in their own church. They began to violate the spirits of English imperialism. And what were they? We've discussed some of them already. anti-Catholicism. The English Parliament, having conquered Canada, passed a law tolerating the Roman Catholic Church in Canada. New Englanders hated that. The peace treaty in 1763 drove the French off the North American continent, only to turn the whole of Louisiana over to the Spaniards, blocking the Western expansion, therefore, of the American colonists. All the new mercantilist navigation acts, all the regulations and monopolies and taxes that Parliament passed, it stifled the economic growth, the capitalist opportunities of colonists. This was contrary to the spirit of English expansion. How dare Parliament tell us we cannot work and achieve and build and grow? And so the American colonists, in a sense, had been allowed to develop with self-government and a tremendous amount of liberty for a century and a half, until after 1763, the British, for their own imperial reasons, began to make new laws and sort of a new dispensation for the new world, that which the American colonists considered a betrayal. And the colonists firmly believed that if Parliament has the right to do this, to do that, to do the other thing, even if the taxes aren't terribly onerous, even if we can smuggle and get around the Navigation Acts, the fact is if we grant the principle that Parliament has the right to impose anything it wants on us, where will it end? And the answer that John Dickinson of Pennsylvania and John Adams of Boston and many other colonists gave was, it ends in slavery.
So the main reason was their economic freedom was being squashed.
Well, yes and no. It was a combination of economic self-interest, of the desire for political freedom and self-government, because after all, in order to get the freedom to pursue our economic interests, the colonists needed to get out from underneath Parliament's political power. That, of course, conjured up all sorts of philosophical notions about sovereignty and self-government and English common law and what is the real status of colonies in the English Empire. We're under the crown, but we're not really under Parliament. How dare they pass laws for us? So ideology came into it, economics, politics, and also religion. Religion is another one of the themes in my book that usually gets ignored by historians, unless they specialize in the history of religion. But there was a very powerful spiritual element to the American Revolution that I was surprised to discover in my research. It's been traced in part to the influence of the so-called First Great Awakening, the great evangelical revival of the earlier 1700s. That really sort of set the template for American Protestant religion, individualistic, anti-authoritarian, self-governing congregations, against all hierarchies, political or religious. Maybe this revival helped sort of sow the seeds of revolution. I think that's true. But also, there was a very widespread sense in the colonies among devout Protestant Christians, but also among deists and rationalists like Franklin and Jefferson, that Britain was corrupt. It was a vile, corrupt, aristocratic country that would corrupt Americans if we allowed them to continue to rule us.
So now, we need
the
to
revolution was also done in the name of virtue as well as freedom.
We need to remember that not all colonists were for revolution. Who was against the revolution, Walter, and what arguments were they making?
Tories came in all shapes and sizes, and that's one of the reasons why they tragically could never sort of get together to defend their loyalty to the crown. They didn't have very much in common. Some Tories were wealthy merchants who had political or economic connections with people back in England. Others were the devout Anglicans. Now we'd call them Episcopalians. I know that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but if you were a devout Church of England person in the colonies, chances are you'd also be very loyal to the king. Some of the immigrant groups tended to be loyalist. Highland Scots, for some reason, which I still haven't figured out, being partly of that background myself. French Huguenots, many of them were loyal to the crown. England had been a champion of Protestantism in the European wars, and so these Protestant French immigrants tended to be loyal to the crown in many cases, not all. and the Germans in Pennsylvania. To them, after what they'd suffered in the old world, King George's yoke seemed light to them. All right, a few taxes, some regulations, you know, we can put up with that. That's far less government than we were used to in the old world. But these pockets of Tory sentiment were spread hither and yon throughout the colonies, and they did have different ethnic backgrounds and religious mixes to them. So the Tories really had trouble coalescing and putting up any kind of a major resistance to the Patriots. And let's face it, as Tom Paine urged in his fiery pamphlet Common Sense, the Patriots in the 13 colonies were pretty fierce about suppressing any Tories among them. We hear about tarring and feathering and that kind of thing. There were property seizures, arrests, and sometimes violence against Tories in the 13 colonies. The American founding was, in my mind, a glorious, glorious event. But it also, the doing of anything in politics, including the American Revolution, is often very ugly.
Well, what amazes me about these 13 colonies after reading the book and just how different they all were is that they all did get together and fight a successful war against a huge, huge power, Britain.
Yes. And again, I would stress they all, the colonies, all the colonies did. You're right. As John Adams said, how was it that 13 clocks were made to strike as one? That was remarkable. But not even all the patriots within all the 13 colonies exhibited, shall we say, the spirit of virtue and sacrifice that Tom Paine and the Continental Congress wanted Americans to display. The American Revolution was very much caught up in this idea that we Americans must prove worthy of our cause, and that indeed God, Providence, the supreme architect of the universe, the father of lights, whatever you want to call the deity, will be on our side if we display the necessary virtue. But guess what? Most of the Americans who volunteered in 1775 or 6 did a six-month militia term and then they went back to their farms. Many Americans, even including patriots, dodged the recruiters and tried to avoid service in the Continental Army. Many farmers sold their crops not to Congress or to Washington's army, but to the Redcoats because they had hard money instead of this Continental paper funny money that the United States of America was issuing. Many Americans, including some of patriot sentiments, traded with the enemy during our War of Independence. So the hustling went on, even in the midst of this virtuous fight for an idealistic new nation.
Isn't that amazing? I never heard those stories before.
It's human nature. That's why I say I'm not forgiving, you know, or I'm not even judging the behavior of our ancestors in the past. I'm merely trying to describe it as realistically as I can and, in a sense, say, hey, we're not the greatest nation or the greatest people on God's green earth, but neither are we the horrible, wicked, imperialistic, Indian-killing savages that some other historians say we are. We're just people set forth on a new, rich continent, free to indulge our human nature.
And do those ideals continue today, Walter? You know, the idea of Americans as hustlers, both in the good sense and bad sense.
I think absolutely. Of course, technology changes, social movements create new forms of behavior and new institutions, but we're hustlers as much today as we ever were in both the positive and the negative senses. And all you have to do is ask yourself how anything gets done in this country. How do you get anything done? You have to engage in a certain amount of corruption. You want to build a new shopping center? How many union, labor unions, businesses, local governments, licensing boards, do you have to go through to get approval just to build a new shopping center? How does Donald Trump build his buildings? Heaven knows how many connections, how many bribes are out there. But the American people are very forgiving of technical corruption, influence peddling, kickbacks, all the rest, if that corruption is perceived to be creative. And by that I mean serving the interests of the community as a whole. Opening new lands for settlement, founding new towns, building a new industry that creates hundreds of thousands of jobs for other striving Americans. Corruption of that sort is creative, and the American people are happy to forgive it, like big city political machines that work, like Mayor Daley's Chicago. But the American people are also profoundly angry at corruption that is perceived to be uncreative, that doesn't serve anybody except the swindlers themselves. And those are the Enron crowd type people, if you will. They are thieves who don't serve the better interests of the United States and the American people. And therefore, if the American people had their way, those people would be hanging from the highest tree.
How much of the original character of these 13 original colonies that we've talked about remains in those colonies, now states, today?
Well, a fraction, of course. Sadly, I would say, too, because in the 1990s, we were all talking about globalization, but good heavens, nationalization, if you will, occurred in this country over many decades, but long before. And it's a sad function, of course, of American market economy, which is a tremendous producer of wealth, but which leads to homogenization. So we have a McDonald's on every corner instead of a ma-and-pa diner. But the other thing is, the American people have always been travelers. They've been restless. They're looking for new opportunities. They're trying to run away from authority. They're trying to reinvent themselves, perhaps, start new lives. So they've always been on the move. And so that means that the original people and cultures that settled the 13 states and the new states out west have now, of course, scribble-scrabbled themselves moving all around the country. You can still see survivals of the original cultures in the attitudes, I think, of people here and there. My upper Middle West, where I grew up near Chicago, was founded largely by New Englanders. In the great Yankee exodus in the early 1800s, they moved into the upper Middle West and they placed a kind of a Yankee stamp on education, culture, town planning, and whatnot in the Middle West. But you're right to ask how much of it survived today. It's more a kind of a folk memory of what New Hampshire used to be like or what Virginia used to be like than the reality today.
Well, Walter McDougall, it's been great to talk to you.
Thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I love you, New Hampshire.
Freedom, just around the corner for you. But with truth so far off, what good will it do?
Walter McDougall's new book is called Freedom Just Around the Corner, A New American History, 1585 to 1828. For a list of upcoming shows on The Exchange, visit the Exchange page at nhpr.org. The Exchange is produced by Keith Shields, Rebecca Kaufman, and Ty Fraley. Dan Colgan is our engineer, Matt McCormick is our intern, and I'm Laura Canoy.